TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. War and Fleas: How Economic Shock Therapy Backfired in Iraq. Naomi Klein, the award-winning journalist and author of the international bestseller No Logo, spoke at a fundraiser for the Middle East Children's Alliance in Oakland in February 2005. She gave her analysis of the election in Iraq and spoke to the abyss between the spin of the new democratic Iraq in the U.S. media and the reality on the ground that she observed firsthand. The wave of privatization instituted by Paul Bremer and reinforced by the International Monetary Fund will not easily be reversed, since the new government needs an impossible-to-reach majority to enact the wishes of the Iraqi people. Here is Naomi Klein.
Thank you all for coming here tonight to support the incredible work of the Middle East Children's Alliance. I'm going to make a few presumptuous assumptions about who you all are and why you're here. I'm going to assume, and you can correct me, please do, that you were against the invasion of Iraq before it happened. I'm going to guess that many of you... marched against the war before it even began, and that you marched again and again after it began. I'm going to guess that you did everything you could to prevent George Bush from winning the elections in November. I'm going to guess that some of you are feeling a little down lately. I'm going to guess that some of you maybe have not yet quite fully recovered from the elections. I'm going to guess that for many of you here, if you're anything like me, reading the newspaper these days reads a little bit like comedy if the real world implications weren't so chilling. I'm thinking of the latest example, the appointing of John Negroponte as Bush's intelligence chief. This is the man who presided over multiple Central American dirty wars and then was occupation chief during this past year in Iraq, or since June 30th, which happened to coincide with the brutal siege on Najaf, which saw U.S. Marines fighting in the sacred burial grounds, their boots stomping on grave sites, who oversaw the siege on Fallujah shortly after the U.S. election, just days after, in fact, a sort of election victory party for the Bush administration, the presiding over uncountable war crimes, the siege on the hospital, the bombing of a healthcare facility, of an emergency health clinic. This is the man who is named as the top intelligence chief. Then there's Elliot Abrams, convicted of lying to Congress about his involvement in getting arms to terror campaigns in the Iran-Contra scandal, circulating phony op-eds, bullying journalists into ignoring war crimes. Of course, Elliot Abrams is in charge of Bush's democracy promotion program around the world. And then there's Michael Chertoff, who oversaw the rounding up of 1,100 Arabs and Muslims, at least in the aftermath of September 11th, the new homeland security czar, and of course, Alberto Gonzalez, appointed as attorney general. And I'm realizing that this is some kind of Republican affirmative action program that they're running here. Because at first it was just realizing that there was no cost, there was no punishment to actively being involved in furthering torture and being directly involved in war crimes. But now I'm realizing that it's actually a job prerequisite for any kind of promotion within the Bush administration. Only war criminals need apply is somehow attached to all the top jobs. Now, I've spent a little time in the U.S. recently. My parents came to Canada during a previous illegal war, and I was lucky enough to be born there. When I talk to my friends in the States, I hear a lot of despair, and I've tried to engage with some of my friends about what Bush has been doing lately. I ask people, did you watch and listen to that inaugural address? Did you listen to the State of the Union? And I keep hearing people say, you know what, I couldn't. I couldn't watch it. I can't look at his face. I can't listen to his voice, okay? Now, you're laughing in recognition, and I know how you feel. I do. But I want to make a pitch to you tonight, which is I really believe that we have to listen. In fact, I believe we have to listen even more closely. First of all, because it is a privilege to even be able to choose to despair, to choose to act or not act. And that in itself is a privilege. Most people are acted upon by the policies of this government. And so long as we have that choice, we must choose to listen. We must choose to listen to Bush at his Orwellian worst and listen closely. We have to understand how he is harnessing our most cherished ideals: freedom from oppression, women's rights, human dignity, democracy, to justify the precise opposite. We cannot turn away in disgust. The reason why we cannot turn away in disgust is because if he is able to do this, if he is able to take our most cherished ideals, it must be in some way because we've left those ideals unattended, of democracy, of economic justice, of genuine equality among all people. If he's able to pick them up and use them to justify occupation, regimes of torture, then those ideas must somehow have been available for the picking. I think we need to look back at this year and be honest about some of the mistakes that were made within our own movements. When the so-called experts on electability in the Democratic Party decided that a presidential campaign was no time to talk about the torture of political prisoners in Guantanamo Bay and in Abu Ghraib, I think far too many of us stayed silent, gave them the benefit of the doubt. We didn't speak up for our own values, for our own principles, for our own ideals when we needed to. Too many of us bit our tongues when we heard John Kerry say again and again in the presidential debates that the U.S. was bearing 95% of the casualties in Iraq and 95% of the financial burden. In those words, he disappeared the 100,000 Iraqis who had died, according to the Lancet study, which came out during the U.S. presidential campaigns and were never mentioned, not to mention the 500,000 Iraqis who died under the sanctions. He didn't mention the $20 billion of Iraq's own oil money that was stolen by the occupation. Americans have not been the primary casualties of this war, and we need to say that. We need to have the courage of our conviction and of our ideals. If we say we believe that all lives are equal, we have to act on it when it matters. When Kerry said you have to stay the course and he presented a more effectively managed occupation as a viable strategy for ending the war in Iraq, I don't think enough of us clearly said that no, occupation is the problem. The only solution is to give Iraq back to the Iraqis, along with the financial tools that are necessary to rebuild their shattered country, a country that was shattered by the funding and arming of their brutal dictator, by the first Gulf War, by the years and years of brutal sanctions, by the second invasion, and by the occupation itself. Now, I'm not saying this to say, I told you so. I'm not saying this to try to dredge up old battles. I'm saying it because I think as we prepare to move forward and as we prepare to fight on, and I know that all of you in coming out here tonight are ready to do that, I think we need to clearly say that the time for those moral compromises are over. We don't make them anymore. If our ideals are being used by our enemies, and I believe they are our enemies, it's because we lost confidence in them. We allowed them to atrophy. We failed to defend them. We failed to embody them in our actions. We failed to breathe new life into them. All ideals need to be kept alive, or they atrophy. So instead of feeling angry and helpless as we listen to George Bush talk about bringing democracy to the world with cruise missiles, we need to become far better pro-democracy activists ourselves. And in doing that, we need to insist on a much deeper definition of democracy and self-determination than he is providing. Of course, a definition of democracy that includes much more than simply voting every few years, but one that includes economic rights as well as individual rights, the right to water, the right to housing, the right to work. And we need to make much stronger links with people around the world who are demanding these rights in the name of democracy around the world. I believe that Iraq is a very good place to start, to show our commitment to these issues. And I think that there is a global fight right now that I see as not the clash of civilizations that we hear so much about, but actually a clash of democracies, of visions of democracies. And it's happening not just in Iraq, but around the world. I mean, we're seeing this incredibly thin version of democracy sold. We saw the same thing happen in Palestine, where not only does democracy not offer the promise of liberation, it is used as an excuse to justify continued occupation. Democracy being used as a weapon of war. As a weapon of war. That's what we're up against. And we can't abandon this language. You know, I hear friends say sometimes, they've tainted these words. We can't use them anymore. And I strongly disagree because these words do matter. They are used. We just need to retake them. We need to infuse them with meaning. We need a deeper democracy. I was in Argentina when the war in Iraq began, and it was that experience that really made me look at it from this perspective. I was in Argentina in 2002, which was immediately after the profound economic crisis had led to the overthrow of the government of Fernando de la Rúa, and then they went through 5 presidents in 3 weeks. The streets were filled with people all the time. There were millions of people who'd been in the streets banging pots and pans, shouting at their political class, "Que se vayan todos," all of them gone, all of them gone. And then they started a movement of grassroots democracy in the neighborhoods across the country. And when I arrived in Argentina about 6 weeks after the government had fallen, everybody who I met said the same thing. They said, the dictatorship just ended. And I didn't know what they were talking about because the dictatorship had ended in 1983. And it was 2002, so what were they saying? And as I talked to more and more people about it, what they said was something had happened, and they hadn't fully realized it at the time, which was when they made the transition from a brutal military regime that had disappeared 30,000 people, had targeted progressives, had tried to disappear the labor movement in the 70s and 80s. When they made the transition to democracy, which was a negotiated transition, which is the case in so many countries, several deals had been struck, several deals had been made, which had drastically limited the type of democracy that they were capable of building afterwards. The most significant deal that was made was the generals had driven up Argentina's debt to $46 billion. They had inherited a country with very little debt because the international financial institutions didn't like the nationalist economic policies of Juan Perón, so they didn't lend him money. They loved the general's policies, and they showered him with cash. About half of it ended up in Swiss bank accounts. Much of it was spent on weapons to build concentration camps to use as torture facilities against progressives, against leftists, against trade union organizers. These debts were odious debts. They did not have to be repaid by the Argentinian people now that they finally had democracy, but that was part of the deal in the transition period. And in inheriting that debt, it shackled them to this endless cycle of IMF structural adjustment programs. So there was this policy of economic continuity, and it was very specific. And in fact, we saw the same thing in South Africa, a negotiated transition, where you had the same head of the central bank, you had the same people in key economic positions from the dictatorship, or in South Africa's case, the apartheid regime, staying in power under the new democracy. This had been negotiated, and so the privatizations began and the mass layoffs. And so when I talk to people in Argentina, in the wake of the economic crash, what they said was, we're finishing the job. We were given the right to vote, but we weren't given the right to jobs. We were denied the right to meet our basic needs. It's not that they were rejecting democracy when they threw their politicians out and said they'd lost faith in the system. It's that they wanted more democracy. They wanted the whole package. They were rejecting the bundling of freedom, of free people and free trade that is, in fact, in the national security strategy of the United States, where it is said that this is part of the same project. In fact, that free trade is a moral right. These are not the same policies. And in fact, in most parts of the world, free people fight these free market policies because it throws them out of work. It denies them their basic services. And when they start to fight against these policies, then they face tremendous state repression, whether in Haiti, Venezuela, Palestine, Iraq. This is the fight. It's a fight between this superficial show of democracy and the deep democracy that people need to survive. It's interesting because RTI, the American company that got the contract to bring local democracy to Iraq, when they arrived in these communities and in these cities to set up local councils, they found something interesting. They found that Iraqis had already gone and elected their own councils. And they came there with flow charts and all of these ideas and lectures about best practices and they plans to privatize the local services. And people said, but we've already elected our own council. And they said, well, you're not ready for that. You have to go back to democracy school. We need to teach you about civil society. So that's the clash, one of the faces of this clash of democracy. Now, I'm sure that all of you saw some of the incredible images that came out of Iraq's elections on January 30th. Women in veils standing in line for hours to cast their votes, willing to risk being blown up to have their say. Those incredible photographs of people holding up their purple fingers and smiling. And remarkable for the only reason that it's so very rare to see Iraqis smiling in our media. So striking. Even images of people dancing. When I was in Iraq, the streets were dead. People were afraid to be in the streets. There was almost no street life. We hear this, that what was remarkable about the elections is that Iraqis stood up to terror. Iraqis stand up to terror every day. They stand up to terror to go to school. They stand up to terror to buy groceries, to go shopping. They stand up to terror to observe their religious holidays. 55 people died trying to observe Ashura in the past 2 days alone in Iraq. So Iraqis stand up to terror every day, and it's nothing to celebrate. It's a fact of life. Valium is sold in liquid form on the streets because Iraq is a terrifying place. It's a terrifying place because of the occupation. It's nothing to celebrate. Of course, we must respect the tremendous risk that Iraqis have taken for democracy. But what I'm going to be talking about tonight has to do with where this story really began and how long Iraqis have been demanding their democratic rights and how systematically those rights have been denied during the occupation. But before that, I just want to tell you a little story. I was amazed by the self-congratulatory tone of the U.S. media coverage. I mean, it was some kind of an all-time low or high or something. This idea that elections in Iraq were just a giant thank you for invading us, George, from the Iraqi people. That was essentially the only analysis that we heard anywhere. And then we had all these people who had opposed the war originally coming forward to say, okay, I was wrong. Clearly, George Bush was right. He really was about bringing democracy to the Iraqi people. And as I was watching this, my mind turned to my late grandmother, my mother's mother. Bear with me a little bit. She had some problems driving. She was never a great driver to begin with. But later in life, she lost a fair bit of her eyesight. And she refused to give up her driver's license because, like many people, it was the source of her independence. And I have this very vivid memory of watching my father try to get the car keys away from my grandmother because she'd become something of a menace to house pets. and mailboxes in Philadelphia. So he was trying to get her to give up her car keys. And she was insisting that she still was a great driver. And her proof of this was that everywhere she went, people were so friendly. She said, everywhere I go, everybody's always waving at me. And I remember watching this conversation, and my father goes, are you sure they're waving with their whole hand? This left quite an impression on me because I was 10 and my father was giving my grandmother the finger. So I thought of this as I was reading this column by Betsy Hart, who's a columnist with Scripps Howard News Service. She described the elections. She said, the Iraqi people gave America the biggest thank you in the best way we could have hoped for. And I just kept thinking, Betsy, are you sure they're waving with their whole hand? Because we actually now know the results of those elections. And they weren't waving with their whole hand. The U.S.-backed Iyad Alawi managed to get a resounding 14% of the vote. 51% of Iraqis cast their ballots for the United Iraqi Alliance. The central plank of the UIA platform was demanding a timetable for the withdrawal of multinational forces from Iraq. In other words, Iraqis were not voting to thank Bush for invading them. They were not waving with their whole hands. Then there were all the people who didn't vote. Sunnis, who make up 20% of the populations, barely voted. Anbar province, where Fallujah is located, had a 2% voter turnout rate. Now, some of this was practical because, of course, Fallujah had been flattened, and the vast majority of Fallujans are still in refugee camps. Their city, remember, was invaded in the name of democracy. Now, some of it was practical, but much of the boycott, the Sunni boycott, was not that people opposed democracy, but the most respected, most influential group representing Sunnis right now is the Association of Muslim Scholars. Their position was that they were in favor of elections, but they were not in favor of elections under occupation, and they made several demands which could easily have been met because actually they were not demanding that the U.S. withdraw before they would have elections. What their demands were, foreign soldiers to pull back to bases, for there to be international oversight over the elections, and for there to be a clear timetable for withdrawal before the vote, because they were worried that the elections would be used as cover to justify the continued occupation, which, of course, is precisely what's happened. Either way, what you have is a clear majority when you take the 51% that voted for the United Iraqi Alliance and the 20% who boycotted, the 20% at least who boycotted, because they wanted a timetable, you have a very clear message of these elections, which is they want an end to the occupation. They voted for it. Now, I want to give you a couple more excerpts from the United Iraqi Alliance platform, because one of the things that I find very interesting is that in all the excitement and celebration about the Iraqi elections, we hear almost nothing about the political platforms of the candidates. In fact, you actually hear Andy Rooney come forward and saying, it doesn't matter who they voted for. What matters is that they voted. Elections as performance art. Here are a few examples of what they voted for, in case you think that matters. A plank of the UIA platform is for the state to guarantee a job to every fit Iraqi and to take care of any Iraqis who are unable to work. To offer, that would be a nice platform for a party here. To offer facilities to build homes, to write off Iraq's debts completely on the grounds that, like Argentina's, they are debts that were accumulated by a brutal regime that waged war on its own people, that the people who lent that money did so knowingly, and that those debts are odious. They also are demanding a canceling of reparations. This is one of the little-known facts of the occupation. You know, in a room like this, we know that Iraq is owed massive reparations from this country, from any of the countries that participated in the sanctions and the first Gulf War, any of the countries that loaned money to Saddam Hussein. We all owe Iraq. We are not paying Iraq anything. Iraq is paying us. Iraq is paying reparations for Saddam's invasion of Kuwait, but the money isn't just going to Kuwait. Anybody, any country, any corporation, any individual that can make any kind of claim that because of Saddam's invasion and occupation of Kuwait, they lost any kind of money whatsoever, can make a claim to the UN Compensation Commission in Geneva, go forward. Iraq was never even allowed to present counter-arguments, wasn't even allowed to see much of the evidence. They would go before the UN Compensation Commission and say, we lost money. Toys R Us got a really good award. Toys R Us said that they would have sold a lot of toys if Saddam had not invaded Kuwait. Burger King got a lot of money. Texaco got millions. Texaco is still owed millions. They're still collecting. Iraqis have only received $8 million in compensation for all the lost lives, for all the damaged property, for all the people who've been tortured. And $4 million of that has come from their own oil money. The U.S. has appropriated Iraq's oil money to pay back Iraqis for their war crimes.
That was the first part of a one-hour speech by the Canadian author and journalist Naomi Klein. She spoke in Oakland, California, in February of 2005. Come back for the conclusion and Naomi Klein's vivid description of the economic reality of Iraq and the betrayal by the false promise of democracy. Naomi Klein is an award-winning journalist and author of the bestseller No Logo, which has been translated into 27 languages. She writes an internationally syndicated column for The Nation, The Guardian, and The Globe and Mail. Her website is www.nologo.org. That's nologo.org. You can find more information on Naomi Klein on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs section. You can get information how to order a copy of the complete one-hour talk by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and helps us stay on the air. This talk by Naomi Klein is also available as a DVD. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape, CD, or DVD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.